scathed? Has Burrell never heard of the so-called culture wars? Has he not noticed the collapse of liberal institutions and values throughout the West in recent decades? Has the immigration crisis has bedeviled Europe in recent years and has recently engulfed the UK, not yet been brought to his attention? Burrell, of course, pointedly fails to mention that all of the problems listed have been severely exacerbated by the ongoing crisis in Eastern Europe. In fact, Borrell does not seem to appreciate that the increasing political and economic stability within the Garden Nations make it increasingly difficult, if not possible, for them to pursue his misguided foreign policy agenda. Obviously, the view from Bruges differs from that from, say, Athens. Second, let us examine Borrell's prescription for exporting Western stability to the jungle states that languished threateningly outside decades of the EU Garden of Eden. Borrell's solution is deceptively simple. Just let the EU gardeners impose Western hegemony on those unstable jungle nations. With it almost goes without saying the helpful assistance of the United States. Readers will not be surprised to learn that Borrell is a keen supporter of the United States. Last year, he stated one thing is clear. Close US-EU cooperation based on shared values is key for international peace, security, and prosperity. Even if his Bruges speech did not explicitly include the US in his imaginary garden, he obviously does not think of it as part of the rest of the world. Borrell apparently has failed to notice that the US has spent the last few decades attempting to implement his foreign policy program in spades, for example, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. He seems unaware that these previous attempts to tame the jungle ended in chaos. Nor, of course, does he acknowledge that many of the problems that plague the jungle nations today were in fact caused by such misconceived interventions. Borrell's entire worldview is nothing more than a global elite fantasy, designed in part to camouflage the unpalatable fact that the Western Garden Nations are in fact becoming more and more like the non-Western jungle countries that he despises and fears. Isn't the political, economic, and social instability that today afflicts almost all Western nations, in large part caused by the West's mistaken foreign policy incursions, precisely the same instability that has beset some non-Western nations for decades? And hasn't this instability intensified dramatically in the West in recent years? Test that proposition by way of a comparison relating to political instability. Brazil has experienced chronic political instability for decades. Prior to the recent presidential election, President Jair Bolsonaro announced that he would not accept the election result if he lost. In the United States, former President Trump refused to accept his election defeat in 2020, culminating in the January 6th Capitol riots. Trump and dozens of candidates endorsed by him have since maintained their position that Joe Biden's 2020 victory was illegitimate. Bolsonaro narrowly lost the recent presidential election in Brazil, but after his defeat, he did not accept the result, even if his supporters staged mass protests in the streets. Trump and many of his candidates are now refusing to accept the results of the U.S. midterm elections, let alone the 2020 result, and Trump intends to run again for president in 2024. Looking at the two countries' relative political stability, where does one put the garden fence? Just this week, two important events highlighted just how divorced from reality Borrell's worldwide view actually is. First, At the COP27 conference in Egypt, the jungle asserted its autonomy by demanding payment of billions of dollars in reparations for the damage done to its countries by climate change. This demand lies completely outside Borrell's crude fame and frame of reference, and perhaps most disturbingly, seems completely justified by the EU's own catastrophic climate change ideology. We suspect that the EU gardeners will find any such reparations a tough sell to EU citizens who cannot pay their energy bills this winter. Second, it is now appears that the Biden administration is placing increasing pressure on Vladimir Zelensky to negotiate a settlement of the conflict in Ukraine, and that this pressure will intensify once the Republicans take control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Where this leaves a fervent and uncritical supporter of the conflict like Borrell, or Zelensky for that matter, is not yet clear. Borrell is nothing more than a rather unsophisticated representative of the global elites that have blindly and rapaciously presided over the decline of European and Western political and economic stability in recent decades.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
United States should take history as a mirror and let it guide the future. That's what the Chinese President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart Joe Biden on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia.
As always, I'm ready to have a candid and in-depth exchange of views with Mr. President on issues of strategic importance in China-US relations and major global and regional issues at our meeting today. I also look forward to working with you to bring China-US relations back to the track of healthy and stable development.
We share responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
The two held their first ever in-person meeting as relations between Washington and Beijing are at their lowest in decades, marred by disagreements over a host of issues from Taiwan to trade. During the landmark three-hour meeting, the Chinese president warned his U.S. counterpart not to cross Beijing's red line over Taiwan. According to the Chinese state media, Xi stressed that Taiwan is the bedrock of the political foundation of bilateral relations. Biden, for his part, said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming conflict. Biden said he sought to assure Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed, seeking to lower tensions over the self-ruled island.
And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all. It's the same exact position we've had. I made it clear that we want to see cross-strait issues peacefully resolved.
On North Korea, Biden told Xi that Beijing has an obligation to attempt to talk Pyongyang out of conducting a seventh nuclear test. U.S.-China relations have been strained in recent years by growing tensions over issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea, trade practices and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Regarding Taiwan, Beijing says it's a matter for the Chinese and China's internal affair. Anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. Tensions over the self-ruled island have intensified following a provocative visit there in August by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The move prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory as well as a declaration by the U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing has time and again slammed U.S. provocations, including encouraging and supporting pro-separatist independence forces on the island, saying that Washington has no right to interfere in how to resolve the Taiwan issue. Also, Biden dropped the hammer on China's semiconductor industry by fully implementing a slew of tough controls on the export of American chip technology to China. It would also undermine China's ability to import, manufacture, and export the semiconductors that run the world. The goal was to slow down and prevent Chinese military and technological advances. Washington also takes sides with Beijing's rivals in a maritime dispute in the South China Sea by routinely sending warships and warplanes to the waters to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation. China has repeatedly called on Washington to stop the provocative actions, which undermine peace and stability in the strategic waters. Last month, the White House and the Pentagon declared Beijing as Washington's most serious strategic competitor, in reports outlining U.S. defense and foreign policy strategies. Therefore, despite Biden's meeting with Xi, can the two manage their differences to prevent conflict, or is it inevitable that the two are on the collision course? On Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron held a meeting with a number of U.S.-based anti-Iran figures at the Élysée. Among them, Masih Alinejad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. In the meeting, Macron described the recent riots in Iran as a revolution. Tehran strongly condemned the meeting, with the foreign ministry slamming it as a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani said it's surprising that the president of a country that advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. Western media tried to portray Masih Alinejad as an activist. Reviewing Alinejad's social media posts, one would notice that much of her online activity revolves around the campaign through which she calls on her followers inside Iran to go on the streets, do something to provoke a reaction, record it, and then send the video file to her for online posting. She calls the campaign My Camera is My Weapon, a campaign hoping to achieve polarization, confrontation, and hatred in Iranian society. She's on the U.S. government payroll. Between 2015 and 2022, the U.S. Agency for Global Media paid Alinejad over $628,000 to use her show to push Iranian women into challenging Iranian laws, while also demanding more sanctions against her country. She has been living in the U.S. for the past decade, working as a full-timer for Voice of America Persian, a media outlet directly funded by the U.S. government, made to capitalize on harmful narratives in favor of Washington's interests. It is interesting but not surprising to see Alinejad being hosted in Élysée Palace by French President Macron, who supported a law in his own country to criminalize the filming and dissemination of images showing the face or other identifying characteristics of a member of the National Police, the so-called Global Security Law, with imprisonment of up to 1 year and a fine of up to €45,000 for the offenders. The meeting with Macron was not the first of its kind. In 2019, Alinejad met Mike Pompeo, then U.S. Secretary of State, a hawkish politician with this mindset.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
In 2018, Alinejad also joyfully met Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, whose hawkish mindset saw the U.S. sanctions killing of 500,000 Iraqi children as a price worth it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice. But the price, we think the price is worth it.
Albright died earlier this year, but the brutal imperialist mindset is still alive and kicking, with the likes of Ahmadinejad advocating for more economic terrorism. The organizer of the meeting between Ahmadinejad and Macron is the New York-based Justice for Kurds group. The co-founders of this organization are Thomas S. Kaplan and Bernard Henry Levy. In Justice for Kurds, they are pursuing the goal of forming the state of Kurdistan, which is the result of the division of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Levy and Kaplan are both linked to the American hawkish group United Against Nuclear Iran, which pressured pharmaceutical firms to stop selling drugs to Iran amid a massive coronavirus outbreak in the country. Levy is a member, while Kaplan is one of the main funders of the group. Levy and Kaplan have lobbied for the interests of Saudi Arabia and the UAE to sanction Iran. Also, in 2019, a report revealed that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates had paid over $35 million to the UANI and its sister organization, the Counter-Extremism Project, over 2 years. In addition to Kaplan, Sheldon Adelson is one of the top donors to UANI. Reports show that Kaplan and Adelson accounted for over three-quarters of the group's total revenue for 2013. The UANI is one of the organizations that Tehran imposed sanctions on in late October for committing human rights violations, interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, encouraging acts of terror, countering Tehran's moves and attempts to fight terrorism, and mounting pressure on the Iranian nation amounting to economic terrorism.
Bahrain has held its general elections. The regime was delighted. Authorities in the Sunni-ruled state, which crushed a 2011 anti-government uprising, said that the vote was free and put the turnout at 73%. But the vote was anything but free and fair. Rights groups called the voting environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. They said there were highly restrictive measures that barred members of banned opposition groups. They added, holding this general election will not address the atmosphere of repression and the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. This, in essence, would make the vote a sham, that it would be void of holding any value. It was no surprise that Bahrainis took to the streets to protest the electoral process and announced that they would boycott the election, since it served the political trajectory of the ruling class. Bahrain experienced an uprising in 2011, still ongoing till this day, in which the Bahraini regime dissolved the main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The regime's crackdown over the past 12 years has been brutal. According to a 61-page report, the court is satisfied with the confession. Bahrain death sentences follow torture, sham trials. The regime has arbitrarily arrested more than 20,000 and tortured more than 6,000 victims. This also includes extrajudicial killings of more than 200 and political death sentences, the dissolution of opposition political societies, and the demolition of 38 mosques. And this is happening in a Persian Gulf country that is a key ally of the U.S. in the region, home to the U.S.'s Navy's Fifth Fleet, and also the United Kingdom, which opened a permanent military base in 2018. Powerful Shia cleric Shariza Qassem has said that the election means normalization. He said the elections constitute a test of the populace's awareness, explaining that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. This would translate into how the electorate, meaning soldiers, dual citizens, security forces, those with personal interests in mind, and normalization advocates, would create a parliament for the government and not the people. The double standard approach by the UK and the US stands out when it comes to the issue of human rights and Bahrain. After all, Bahraini courts have convicted and sentenced defendants to death following manifestly unfair trials, based solely or primarily on confessions, allegedly coerced through torture and ill-treatment. The governments of the US and the UK, as well as the European Union and its member states, should urge Bahrain, through both public and diplomatic channels, to halt all executions and to seriously investigate torture allegations and violations of the right to a fair trial. Yet they have chosen to do that with other countries, for example, Iran, which ironically has rioters out on the streets, endangering Iran's national security. According to Iran's intelligence minister, both the U.S. and the U.K. even have a hand in the deadly protests, like through the CIA. A recent visit of the Pope to Bahrain posed an opportunity for the plight of Bahrainis to be addressed. 130 human rights organizations appealed to the Pope of the Vatican to demand the release of prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. They asked them to adopt an initiative urging the Bahraini authorities to end violations. But those hopes are dim. These 130 human rights organizations have cited how so many Bahrainis have faced discrimination, jail time, and torture. Yet Bahrain has always shifted the blame to Iran for the unrest. Could 130 human rights organizations be wrong, or for them to be lying? But Bahrain ultimately cannot have a democratic process because its big brother Saudi Arabia, which is just a stone's throw away, will be threatened by democracy taking place next door and will vehemently reject this, since it cannot risk having democracy creep into the kingdom. After all, Bahrain is joined only by a causeway to Saudi Arabia.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian warns of negative consequences if the UNHRC were to go ahead with demands of the West. He criticized the Western double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. In a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said, "Contrary to the UN Charter, few Western countries exploited the peaceful demands in Iran and encouraged violence and offered tutorials on building weapons and Molotov cocktails on media and social networks, which led to the killing of police and insecurity in Iran." He says that if a session is to be held on the riots in Iran, it should in fact probe into foreign governments' role in encouraging violence and terror and not on the country that is a true defender of human rights. What Amir Abdullahian is referring to is the piling evidence of actual foreign involvement in the riots, perhaps the most compelling of which was revealed through a joint statement by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the Ministry of Intelligence. In it, the country's two top intelligence bodies pointed out the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the riots. They revealed that they have gone as far as dividing the riots in different stages of pre-unrest, during unrest, and post-unrest. Perhaps the primary way foreign governments, especially the US, UK, and Saudi Arabia, were involved was through supporting foreign Farsi-speaking media that played on people's emotions over a tragic death and capitalized on existing grievances to attempt to overthrow the Islamic establishment through something like a coup d'etat. Iran has warned the UK of consequences for hosting the so-called Iran International Channel, which Iran has recognized as a terrorist organization. Iran also warned Germany for voicing its support for the rioters and calling on the EU to implement more sanctions against Iran. Amir Saeed Iravani, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, responded to the U.S. cries of women's rights and human rights being violated in Iran and its calls for a special session to, quote, highlight the ongoing repression of women and girls and members of religious and ethnic minority groups by saying this. "The United States lacks the political, moral, and legal qualifications to hold such a meeting, distorting the very basic principles of human rights." He also added, "The U.S. has no true and genuine concern about the human rights situation in Iran or elsewhere." Perhaps he was referring to the role that the U.S. has been playing in destabilizing the West Asia region and carrying out terrorist attacks there. Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya, and its unwavering support for Israeli crimes against Palestinians, don't even begin to tell the whole story on U.S.'s destabilizing acts in the region. The U.K.'s involvement in Syria, funding terrorist groups, and being one of the coalition members of the fight against Yemen also nullifies their cries over human rights violations, anywhere in the world.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new report finds that the U.S. War Department uses security cooperation programs for secret wars. In this regard, we have provided the views and attitudes of world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Responsible Statecraft wrote, U.S. military forces have been engaged in unauthorized hostilities in many more countries than the Pentagon has disclosed to Congress, let alone the public, according to a major new report released recently by New York University School of Law's Brennan Center for Justice. Afghanistan, Iraq, maybe Libya. If you ask the average American where the United States has been at war in the past two decades, you would likely get this short list, according to the report, adding, secret war, how the U.S. uses partnerships and proxy forces to wage war under the radar. But this list is wrong, off by at least 17 countries in which the United States has engaged in armed conflict through ground forces, proxy forces, or airstrikes. The report's author, Catherine Yan Ebright, wrote in the introduction, this proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported counties contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations. The 39-page report focuses on so-called security cooperation programs authorized by Congress pursuant to the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, or AUMF, against certain terrorist groups. One such program, known as Section 127E, authorized the Defense Department to provide support to foreign forces, irregular forces, groups, or individuals engaged in supporting or facilitating authorized ongoing military operations by United States Special Operations Forces to combat terrorism. According to the report, that support has been broadly, or more accurately, too broadly interpreted by the Pentagon. In practice, it has enabled the U.S. military to develop and control proxy forces that fight on behalf of, and sometimes alongside U.S. forces, and to use armed force to defend its local partners against adversaries in what the Pentagon calls collective self-defense, regardless of whether those adversaries pose any threat to U.S. territory or persons. And in some cases, whether or not the adversaries have been officially designated as legitimate targets under the 2001 AUMF. In Somalia in 2016, for example, U.S. forces invoked collective self-defense to launch a strike against a rival militia of the Puntland Security Force, an elite brigade that had originally been recruited, trained, and equipped by the CIA and subsequently taken over by the Pentagon in 2011. Moreover, the Pentagon deployed the PSF, which was largely independent of the Somali government, to fight Al-Shabaab and IS of Somalia, sometimes alongside U.S. forces for several years before the executive branch designated Al-Shabaab as legitimate targets. It has never so designated the ISS. Similarly, in Cameroon, U.S. forces accompanying a partner force on an advise and assist mission ended up shooting and killing an adversary. The Pentagon has used a Section 127 program there to pursue leaders of Boko Haram, a terrorist group that has never been publicly identified as an associated force of Al-Qaeda, and thus a lawful target under the 2001 AUMF, according to the report. Congress rarely hears of these incidents because, according to the report, the Department of War insists they are too minor or episodic to raise to the level of hostilities that would trigger reporting requirements under the 1973 War Powers Resolution. The report, which relies on published work by investigative reporters, interviews with knowledgeable officials and congressional staff, official documents and records, as well as the author's legal analysis, identifies 13 countries with Section 127E programs in addition to Somalia and Cameroon. They include Afghanistan, Egypt, Iraq, Kenya, Lebanon, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Nigeria, Syria, Tunisia, and Yemen. But it is stressed that the list is almost certainly not exhaustive. 50 countries, from Mexico to Peru, in the west to Indonesia and the Philippines, where U.S. forces are known to have taken part in combat operation in the east, and covering 22 countries in North and Sub-Saharan Africa alone, not to mention Ukraine, had Section 333 programs in place as of mid-2018, according to the report. Perhaps even more dangerous than the Section 127E counterterrorism programs, according to the report, are security cooperation programs undertaken pursuant to Section 1202 of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2018, using language that mirrors Section 127E. That provision goes beyond the counterterrorism purposes of Section 1273E by authorizing support to partner forces engaged in supporting or facilitating irregular warfare operations by the United States Special Operations Forces. Irregular warfare is identified by DOD as competition, short of traditional armed conflict or all-out war. Pentagon officials have described Section 1202 as a highly useful tool for enabling irregular warfare operations to deter and defeat revisionist powers and rogue regimes. They have also insisted that irregular warfare is likely to be increasingly relied on as DOD begins to prioritize great power competition. Broadly speaking, the purpose of the Section 1202 authority is to take the Department's Section 127E approach of creating and controlling partner forces and wield it against countries like North Korea, according to the report. Section 1202, in short, raises the same potential as 127E for hostilities that Congress has not authorized, but with far graver consequences because the enemy could be a powerful nuclear-armed state. given the increased risks, simply repealing or reforming outdated and overstretched AUMFs is insufficient. The report includes Congress should repeal or reform Department of Defense Security Cooperation Authorities. Until it does so, the nation will continue to be at war, without in some cases the consent or even knowledge of its people, it added.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny. Particularly the vestige of God remaining on earth. Welcome, my dear ones, our youth, our teenagers. You have made the environment in this Husseinia very pleasant. Your pure hearts, your souls, filled with passion, illuminate the environment and make it pleasant. Wherever you may be, whatever that environment that might be, I have prepared some related topics which I would like to share with you today, my dear children.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The first topic is about the 13th of Aban. Well, you have heard a lot about it. The 13th of Aban is a historic day. It is both historic and educational. When we say it is a historic day, it means that on this day there were events that will remain in history. These events cannot be forgotten, and they shouldn't be forgotten either. They are educational because there have been reactions as a result of these events that serve as a lesson for us. Make use of these experiences for the future of the country, for your future, and for the future of our nation. The future belongs to you. This day is an important day for us, but it also really agitates the Americans. This is a day that frustrates the Americans whenever it is commemorated. Your meeting, this meeting, when it is shown, you can be sure that the Americans will be angered by this gathering, this anthem, this communion. They will be agitated by it. Why? Because this day is the embodiment of the evil of the United States and its defeat.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., twice impeached former President Donald Trump announces his 2024 run for presidency despite Republicans' lackluster performance in midterm elections and a surge from his rival Ron DeSantis. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Donald Trump on Tuesday night, 15th of November, announced his candidacy for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, likely sparking another period of tumult in U.S. politics and especially in his own political party. In order to make America great and glorious again, I'm tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States, Trump said from the ballroom of his Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, Florida, where he stood on a stage crowded with American flags and Make America Great Again banners. Vowing to defeat Joe Biden in 2024, he declared, America's golden age is just ahead. The long-expected announcement by a twice-impeached president who incited a deadly attack on Congress seems guaranteed to deepen a partisan divide that has fueled fears of increased political violence in the United States. But it also comes as Donald Trump's standing in the Republican Party has suddenly been put into question. Trump spoke at Mar-a-Lago just a week after midterm elections, in which his Republican Party did not make the expected gains, losing the Senate and seeming on course for only a narrow majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. In his remarks, Donald Trump took credit for Republicans' victory in the House, even though they are poised to capture a far narrower majority than anticipated. Nancy Pelosi has been fired, isn't that nice? He said. The Associated Press has not yet projected which party will win the majority in the House. In a party hitherto dominated by Trump, defeats suffered by high-profile Trump-endorsed candidates led to open attacks on the former president and calls to delay his announcement or not to run at all. As Trump's standing has slipped, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has surged into strong contention after sailing to re-election last week. Donald Trump's announcement also coincided on Tuesday with the release of Mike Pence's memoir, So Help Me God, in which the former vice president criticizes Trump for his conduct on 6th of January 2021. The former vice president is also maneuvering towards a possible 2024 run despite falling out of favor with the MAGA base. Brushing past Republican setbacks in 2022 and his defeat in 2020 election, Donald Trump insisted that he was the only candidate who could deliver a Republican victory in 2024. This is not a task for a politician or a conventional candidate, he said. This is a task for a great movement. His third candidacy comes as he faces intensifying legal troubles, including investigations by the Justice Department into removal of hundreds of classified documents from the White House to his Florida state, and also his role in the 6th of January attack on Congress. Donald Trump has denied wrongdoing and used the attacks to further his narrative that he has been unfairly targeted by his political opponents and a shadowy deep state bureaucracy. "I'm a victim," Trump said, making reference to the Russia investigation and the raid on his Mar-a-Lago state. On Tuesday, Donald Trump nevertheless pressed forward with his run for presidency. Painting a bleak portrait of America with blood-soaked city streets and an invasion at the southern border, Donald Trump said his campaign was a quest to save our country. In the less than 2 years since Joe Biden took office, a period Trump referred to as the pause, he accused his successor of inflicting pain, hardship, anxiety and despair with his economic and domestic policies. Trump offered an alternative vision, which he called the National Greatness Agenda. Among the policy proposals he endorsed on Tuesday were the death penalty for drug dealers, term limits for members of Congress, and planting an American flag on Mars. And wading into the social fights he enjoys inflaming, Trump promised to protect paternal rights. CBS News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump announced on Tuesday night, 15th of November, from his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, that he's running for president a third time. Trump announced his 2024 bid just moments after filing a statement of candidacy with the Federal Election Commission. "In order to make America great and glorious again, I'm tonight announcing my candidacy for president of the United States," Trump said to cheers from his supporters. When he entered the room, along with former First Lady Melania Trump, the former president was introduced as the next president of the United States, teasing his announcement. Trump is the first major candidate to formally announce a 2024 presidential bid. "2 years ago, we were a great nation, and soon we will be a great nation again," Trump, 76-year-old, told his supporters in a speech that was often more subdued than many of his various rallies. Much of Trump's roughly hour-long speech represented a reaction to Joe Biden's presidency, as Trump blasted gas prices, inflation, and energy policy under the current president. "This is not just a campaign," he said. "This is a quest to save our country." Donald Trump has been expected to announce on Tuesday night that he's running for president a third time, and he's been hinting in recent weeks that he would. "I will very, very probably do it again," Trump told rallygoers in Iowa earlier this month. Asked in Indonesia if he had a reaction to Donald Trump's announcement, Joe Biden said, "No, not really." Republicans are still reeling from voters' rejection of several of their candidates for key races, many of whom have been endorsed and even handpicked by Donald Trump. Still, Trump insisted during his announcement that the midterm election results represented a great night for his candidates. Some Republicans blamed Trump for boosting a slate of extremist candidates who were ultimately rejected by independent voters and did little to motivate base voters. "The party needs to get past Donald Trump," retiring Pennsylvania GOP Senator Pat Toomey said after the election. Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman defeated Republican Mehmet Oz in the race for Senator Pat Toomey's seat in Pennsylvania. Former Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican, also suggested that Donald Trump's hold on the GOP ultimately harmed their chances of a red wave. There's significant influence from the former president, and I think that influence probably hurt the party and hurt the party's chances on election day, Charlie Baker told CNN. Donald Trump is also facing criticism from his former vice president Mike Pence after the 6th of January 2021 assault on Congress led to a rift between the two of them. Asked by ABC News whether he believes Donald Trump should be president again, the former vice president Mike Pence said it was up to the American people, but he said, "I think we'll have better choices in the future." Mike Pence is considered a potential candidate for president in 2024. Some Trump allies urged the former president to wait until after the 6th of December Georgia runoff election between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and his Republican challenger Herschel Walker. But Donald Trump ignored those calls. He thought it would look weak if he merely announced an exploratory committee and not his campaign, a senior advisor told CBS News last week. On the day his announcement was expected, even one of his closest allies, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, said he didn't think that Donald Trump should announce his White House bid as yet.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Monday, the European Union announced new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and three organizations, including Iran's 24-hour English news channel Press TV, for alleged crackdown on protests which began following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who collapsed in police custody and was pronounced dead a few days later at hospital. The state broadcaster is accused of airing, quote, forced confessions of detainees, according to an EU statement. A baseless claim that has surprised Press TV staff and managers, as no such forced confessions have been produced or broadcast by the English-language news channel during the recent riots. On the contrary, the news channel has made a great effort to counter fake narratives fostered by Western media.
They make claims about Press TV producing and airing forced confessions. I've been working here at Press TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Press TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. You know, I see this as part of their hybrid warfare against Iran. If you look at the big picture, you see them supporting terrorist groups. And these sanctions on Press TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Press TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
Riots broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Mahsa Amini. Rioters brutally attacked security officers and caused massive damage to public property. Iran's intelligence ministry has revealed that the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. Experts believe that sanctions imposed on Press TV by the EU and earlier by the government of Canada are aimed at muzzling free speech and alternative views. And once again, the term human rights violations has turned into a tool for Western countries to advance their own agenda, as street riots in Iran don't seem to be achieving the goals they expected. Taking into consideration all the different aspects, Press TV is not discouraged by the unfair treatment and false accusations. Despite all obstacles, Press TV will continue to be the voice of the voiceless, reporting underreported stories and news overlooked by mainstream media. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
When there's mutual trust, a deal is a deal. It's this easy to arrive at an agreement when the two sides of the bargain are from Russia and Iran. These B2B meetings come as part of an economic forum held in Tehran between Iranian businesses and over 100 companies from Russia.
We're a Russian logistic company, and we're here to participate in this business forum to find some partners for business with Iran. We are thinking to transport goods to Iran, from Iran, through Iran.
Our activity is about gas, oil, petrochemical equipment, machinery, instrument. We can export many items to Russian companies. For example, as the machinery, as raw material, and it can help both sides to develop their business relationship as soon as possible.
Tehran and Moscow's interests coincide on many fronts. Both are faced with U.S. sanctions, and both are signatories to the 2015 deal, which has faced troubles following the U.S. withdrawal from the pact in 2018 and the reinstatement of sanctions on Iran. While the bans have adversely affected the Russo-Iranian trade, businessmen here believe there's a strong will from both Tehran and Moscow to overcome those restrictions.
I don't think it will be like a very, very big problem for our countries. Just, we have a border, we have a Caspian Sea, and we can transport cargo. This sanction, it is some problem for the trading, for the money transferring, but it's okay for logistics, no problem.
The American measures have complicated the Russian-Iranian commercial ties when it comes to money transfer and banking transactions. While alternatives such as the use of national currencies have already paid off, legal experts attending this forum say they have a better way out. cryptocurrency.
Using cryptocurrencies, Iran and Moscow can effectively ditch the U.S. dollar. So if the two sides include this transaction method in their contracts, they can proceed with their businesses seamlessly without any concern over the impacts of U.S. measures.
Visits between Iranian and Russian officials have in recent months increased, following the West tightening its economic measures against both countries.